I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Puerto Rico in the Dark brings the disaster story of the season to a sort of point, if not to an end. On American soil, a territory of 3.5 million U.S. citizens is unplugged, stripped of shelter, desperate for months yet to come. More people than in the Dakotas, Wyoming, Alaska, and Vermont combined. Their lights out, refrigeration too, hospitals closed, food crops destroyed, not much Wi-Fi either. In a fully foreseeable crisis, some combination of forces seems to have chosen unreadiness as the first response. What we learned from New Orleans under Katrina 12 years ago is staring out of the Caribbean again. It is man-made patterns of history, empire, money, and power that turn storms into disasters, that sort out who lives, who dies, and who pays for the destabilization of the human habitat. A succinct and dignified case against the unfairness in the picture has been laid out before the United Nations by Roosevelt Skerrett, the Prime Minister of tiny Dominica, his island and his own house smashed to bits by Hurricane Maria.
Mr. President, I come to you straight from the front line of the war on climate change. Warmer air and sea temperatures have permanently altered the climate between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn. Heat is the fuel that takes ordinary storms, storms we could normally master in our sleep, and supercharges them into a devastating force. In the past, we would prepare for one heavy storm a year. Now, thousands of storms form on a breeze in the mid-Atlantic and line up to pound us with maximum force and fury. Before this century, no other generation had seen more than one Category 5 hurricane in their lifetime. In this century, this has happened twice, and notably, it has happened in the space of just 2 weeks. Mr. President, to deny climate change is to procrastinate while the earth sinks. It is to deny a truth we have just lived. We as a country and as a region did not start this war against nature. We did not provoke it. The war has come to us. My fellow leaders, there is no more time for conversation. While the big countries talk, the small island nations suffer. We in the Caribbean do not produce greenhouse gases or sulfate aerosols. We have made no contribution to global warming that can move the needle. But yet, we are among the main victims on the front line. In the Commonwealth of Dominica, we have long pursued and respected an existence that preserves our little Eden. But what is our reality at this moment? Pure devastation. We are shouldering the consequences of the actions of others, actions that endanger our very existence, and all for the enrichment of a few elsewhere. The desolation is beyond imagination. The stars have fallen. Eden is broken.
That was the statuesque Prime Minister of Dominica, Roosevelt Skerrett, at the UN last week. This matter of environmental justice is the thread through this radio hour, through a few centuries of relevant history, too. Environmental borders between haves and have-nots are clear, and as Mr. Skerrett just said, there are color lines everywhere. Stuart Schwartz at Yale is our historian of the 500-year interaction of weather and people in the Caribbean. The Sea of Storms, as he titled a remarkable book. The European Christians who got to the West Indies in the 16th century had never seen such weather, he said, and they read it first as God's hand, then as whimsical nature, eventually as human failure.
The problem with natural disasters is that they're never natural. A hurricane that passes over an uninhabited island is just a natural phenomenon. It's not a disaster. It becomes a disaster by what people do before or after the natural phenomenon.
Is there any lesson here, Stuart Schwartz, that isn't mortally embarrassing, going back to the history of colonialism, to the fecklessness of the federal government's responses in Katrina, even today, a complete unpreparedness for a totally predictable disaster in Puerto Rico, for example? I mean, where does it end, and where are we going?
Here you really get into sort of different views of politics. One view is we know from the history of hurricanes that poor countries and poor people in countries are the ones who always suffer the most from these natural disasters. We know that. So one reaction has been, well, then the best way to deal with this is not trying to change global warming or to spend a lot of money on defense. The best thing to do is to make everybody wealthier, promote jobs, the kind of neoliberal strategy, let the market operate. That's the best way to handle natural disaster. The other is to do far more in terms of trying to control global warming or climatic change and to make preparations when the disasters take place. The idea that if you cut the budget for the federal government and you remove the budget from these kinds of operations in order to use them for other things or simply to lower taxes, then this is one of the results that happens. This money to build dams or levees or to do the kind of preparations that would lessen these kinds of disasters, how you spend that money is contested. And there are different ways of seeing the world and different ways of looking at economics that drive the two sides of the debate.
Fit Puerto Rico today into the history you're telling.
Of course, our history with Puerto Rico starts in 1898 with the Spanish-American War. And in fact, the birth of Puerto Rico as American territory, the delivery was through a hurricane. The United States occupied Puerto Rico in end of 1898. Puerto Rico was under military government. And in 1899, in August of 1899, the island was hit by a tremendous hurricane, even worse than the one that just hit Puerto Rico. Puerto Ricans call it the San Ciriaco hurricane. Puerto Ricans name the hurricane by the day of the saint that they occur on. So the hurricane hit Puerto Rico, covered the whole island, and it wrecked the island. 3,000 people were killed.
Wow.
This happened while it was under American administration. And so right at that moment, the United States mounted a tremendous charity relief effort, not the government, but private charities throughout the United States, because the desire of the United States was to demonstrate to these new responsibility of the United States, this new territory, about the beneficence of the United States. So we wanted to display that. So a lot of money was raised. Every American city had a charity board to raise money for Puerto Rico.
These were churches?
Churches, but also civilian boards. Every large city sent stuff. Private companies sent charity at the time. Congress did not vote any money for Puerto Rico at the time. But then the governor and a charity board in Puerto Rico, plus the planters in Puerto Rico, said, well, if you give money to these destitute people, who's going to cut the sugar cane? Who's going to pick the coffee bushes? And so the charity was given to Puerto Rico, but not to the victims. It was given to the planters. And then in order to get some, you had to sign a contract that you'd be working, and then you could get a pound of food a day per family member from the planters. What it did was reinforce the position of the planters on the island. And it also convinced the American Congress that this island couldn't stand on its feet by itself. And so the storm kind of determined that Puerto Rico just wasn't able to take care of itself because of the storm.
Stuart Schwartz, are you explaining why Cuba, which was, of course, a Spanish colony, seems to stand out on the map today as having fortified itself against these storms and survived pretty well over many years?
Well, I think that the Cuba story is a more recent one. The Cuba story dates from 1963.
Early Castro.
Yeah, under Castro. And that year, Cuba was hit by a very bad storm, Hurricane Flora. It went right to the Caribbean and killed a lot of people in Haiti. And then hit Cuba, and it was a funny storm. It's sort of like the one that just hit Houston, in that the storm came over half the island of Cuba and then flipped and went back the other way. That is, it went right back over the same area it had crossed. And so it dumped an enormous amount of rain on the island. And 1963 was right after the Cuban Missile Crisis that had embarrassed Castro because the Russians had basically left him high and dry when it cut the deal with the U.S. And so Castro needed to kind of reinforce his image as a leader, etc. So he mobilized a tremendous effort after Hurricane Flora. He called out the troops. They had tanks out removing people, and it was very successful. Some people died, but very few in comparison to the damage that was done. And it convinced Castro and Che Guevara at the time that what they needed to do for Cuba at all times was to create the same spirit that they had created of cooperation and participation that had taken place during the hurricane, the recovery from the hurricane. And that's what then convinced Castro that this kind of hurricane defense business was really good for the image of the government and important in a place like Cuba that was, you know, it's right in the middle of the zone. It's a big target for hurricanes. The island is 1,000 miles long. And so Cuba became the kind of poster child for how countries should prepare and develop systems to respond to hurricanes. The United Nations uses them as a model for small countries. And the Cubans, of course, have just offered to send electricians and medical teams to Puerto Rico. Of course, we won't accept. We never do. But Cuba's really got a lot of experience in doing this, and they do it relatively well.
It is simply amazing that all these years, most of my lifetime, we've thought of communism coming to Cuba as more dangerous than, you know, infinitely destructive storms.
Well, it's true. You know, at the time in 1963, Castro made a famous speech in which he said, a revolution is stronger than a hurricane.
Did anybody get it right here since Katrina? As right as Cuba, say, in building shelters for people in a disaster.
It's not a matter of socialism versus capitalism. Vietnam's a socialist country. It's got a relatively poor record on responding to natural disasters. Japan's a capitalist country. It's got a relatively good record in responding, except for the recent nuclear disaster. But the issue isn't the form of government. The issue is the willingness of a government to invest in what needs to be done.
Coming up, the shaking of confidence fanning out of the climate crisis in our politics, our economic order, our sense of the future. What drives what here? This is Open Source. Kumi Naidu is a global activist from South Africa who sees the fight for environmental justice as a natural extension of his own anti-apartheid struggles as a teenager and his leadership till 2 years ago of Greenpeace International.
There's this uncomfortable term that I'd like to also put into the conversation, and that of climate apartheid. It is very uncomfortable when we look at which parts of the world carry the biggest historical responsibility for carbon accumulation and the reality of climate catastrophe that we're already beginning to experience now through the spike in extreme weather events. And then we look at which parts of the world created the problem, and which part of the world that are paying the first and most brutal price. It's a very uncomfortable racial picture, right? That it's mainly people of color who are actually globally, and by the way, including in the United States, who are in the front line of impacts. I mean, if you look at Hurricane Sandy or you look at Hurricane Katrina, if you look at the people that, you know, suffered the most, firstly, let's be clear, it was working class people, white working class, black working class, Latinos, and so on. But when you look at it from a racial perspective, it's a disproportionately people of color that actually paid the most brutal price because of racial inequality in the United States itself.
How many of these lessons did you learn in apartheid South Africa?
You know, truth be said, I got involved as a young activist at the age of 15. At that time, environmental activism was seen by many of us incorrectly as a luxury. Environmental activism was what white people and rich people did. It took my daughter, to be honest, in my 30s, it took my daughter to actually say to me, Dad, you need to read up and understand that, in fact, the biggest threat to humanity is, in fact, climate catastrophe. And now it's totally clear. I mean, in South Africa right now, and Southern Africa more generally, we're experiencing exactly what the climate scientists told us decades ago that we will hit extreme drought. The implications for us is that rural people who have been suffering already, and then you add on top of it the impacts of drought, it means that people are on the verge of desperation. So when you put all of these things together, I think that what I learned from the anti-apartheid struggle, which is very, very relevant to the moment, is this very simple thing. If history taught us anything, is that when humanity faced a major injustice or a major challenge, those struggles only went forward when decent men and women stood up and said, enough is enough and no more. We are prepared to go to prison if necessary. We prepared to give our lives if necessary. The main message I think I take from the liberation struggle from South Africa is the struggle for justice is not a popularity contest. Activism against injustice, when you're going up against power, you are going to be vilified. But we have to have a sense that the struggle for justice, it's going to take time, it's going to take perseverance and so on. Mm. And I urge particularly young people, stand up, take leadership.
Yeah.
Because quite frankly, if I'm brutal, my generation, I'm 52 now, and the older generations have run out of fresh ideas. It's absurd to see this nuclear conversation going out between North Korea and the Trump administration. I mean, you cannot almost believe that we are still at that moment. So in this moment of what might appear to be pessimism and also a sense of crisis, I want to urge people to have this sense that this is not a time for pessimism. This is a time for courage. This is a time for us to celebrate our humanity. This is a time for us to do what many American cities and states are doing, which is if Donald Trump wants to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement, okay, but we will continue to build our cities and our states in alliance with brothers and sisters across the world. And that's the kind of mentality that we want to see. And to end on a positive note, there is a quotation from Mahatma Gandhi that should give us a little bit of comfort. Gandhi once said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. The good news is the fossil fuel industry and governments are not ignoring us, they're not laughing at us, they're fighting at us. And if Gandhi was right, let's hope we are one step away from winning societies and a world at large where there's greater equality, where we avert climate catastrophe, and we create a much more equal and just societies.
Kumi Naidoo spoke with us this week from Seattle. This can feel like an all-purpose apocalypse, but what connections are we really ready to see among the several pieces coming apart here in war and rumors of war, in the weather, extreme politics, sinking dreams of a common future? Jason Moore is our social and environmental historian with a wake-up argument that the critical combination in our world today is carbon and capitalism. His book is Capitalism in the Web of Life. Jason Moore, welcome. Take apart the convergences here, racial, social, environmental, economic crises. Can you put them in order?
We absolutely can. Well, Comrade Naidoo is absolutely right. To begin with this key concept of planetary climate apartheid. And what we need to do is to understand where this came from. Where and when did this absolutely disastrous state of affairs in the world, which is at once social and cultural and ecological, so deeply entangled we can't separate them out. Where and when did this begin? So for most environmentalists, and even for most climate activists, I think they would say precisely when the smoke and carbon starts to belch out of those Manchester textile factories in England in the 1830s and 40s. And I would say, wait a minute, that was a moment. But we have to understand that the origins of fossil fuels, so not just coal, a rock in the ground, but the origins of fossil fuel go back to the 16th century, and that they were interlaced with the origins of the modern food system and the system of industrial agriculture, which emerges out of slavery, So race and racism is there at the beginning with a profound destructiveness towards environments of every kind, but also the creation of this idea that there could be modern enrichment and economic growth apart from the web of life. So the whole domain could be set up called nature. And guess what? Most humans at that time in the 16th century, but even for most of the 20th century, most humans were expelled not just from their lands, but from society and put into this realm of nature. So the Irish were wild and savage, indigenous peoples, Africans, women were all moved out of humanity and put into this category of nature and treated cheaply, treated as a prop to enrich the very few.
So come to the combination of a carbon economy and capitalism. Especially interesting because it used to be the Rockefeller brothers embodied the power of the two. Now it's the Koch brothers. It seemed make the point that this is what we're facing.
Well, carbon is being spewed into our bodies, into our food, into our global atmosphere, because there is a sense of nature as not just a source of cheap inputs of food and energy and raw materials, but also that all of the planet exists as a garbage can for the rich to put their effluents and pollutions. And that has to be central to how we think about capitalism, because capitalism isn't just an economic system. It's a way of organizing nature, and it's a way of using nature to cheapen life and to treat nature as a way to avoid paying their bills.
So many elements here. Would you just consider, Jason, that we've got a new nature, capital N, and it's angry and it's not responsive. The history of the environmental movement begins to sound very, very quaint, going back to Earth Day and the Sierra Club and Rio and Kyoto and Paris. We're in a new place about big N nature. Can we handle it? Do we even know how to think about it?
No, we don't know how to think about it. For instance, the language of a war on nature has been used widely by environmentalists. I think that's wrong. I think that there are wars going on. If there is a war, it is within the web of life, and it is a class war. That we have to understand that the question of sustainability is a question of work and life. And as Naidu said, that there can be no separation of the questions of economic and social justice from environmental justice. So what we have to do is to come to terms with, I think this is what you're getting at, a massive and radical and epical shift where for a long time, the web of life could be used by capitalists and empires to avoid paying their bills and to make them richer and more profitable. Now we're seeing a dramatic inversion of that. That not only is the web of life not there to dump wastes and for free without consequence, but now we're seeing the feedback that rising CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere are suppressing the whole reason you and I can sit here and have this conversation, modern agriculture. It is suppressing agricultural growth, and it's making the food itself, the crops themselves, less nutritious.
We got to come back to the Koch brothers and the virtual ownership by the carbon capitalists of our government, our Congress for sure, President Trump probably too. But first, Christian Parenti joins us. He's an investigative reporter with a PhD in sociology. His new book is Tropic of Chaos. Christian Parenti, give us you follow the inventory of climate effects outside the Caribbean and the ones we don't see. Give us a taste.
Of the effects of climate change in the global south? I didn't quite hear you, but I think that's what you're
asking. Well, yeah, the ones we're focused, partly because we're in the same Caribbean storm track, but outside our world, the ones you've covered, the ones you know.
There's this pattern of extreme weather everywhere, increased drought punctuated by increased flooding. You see in many places it's actually increased overall precipitation, but it comes all at once and then is interspersed with long and intense droughts. And the thing is, frequently in the global south, climate change, the effects, the political and social and economic effects of climate change don't appear immediately like the effects of climate change because they intermingle with and are articulated through two previously existing crises, which is the crises of free market fundamentalist restructuring that has been pushed on the economies of the global south for 30 years now, which has reduced the public sector to a set of inadequate institutions that don't really have the capacity to respond to, say, pastoralists whose herds are dying because of increased drought punctuated by flooding.
Pushed on them by whom, Christian? Well, you say it's been pushed on the global south, but by whom?
By the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, in the name of fiscal rectitude and economic efficiency, these institutions, in response to the debt crisis of the 1980s and 90s, has imposed austerity on one country after another, saying that the way you can balance your books is you sell off state companies, you open your markets, you cut public funding for education, healthcare, veterinary services, and if you do that, then investment will flow in, you'll have economic growth, and everything will work out. But instead, what that agenda, broadly called neoliberalism, has achieved more often than not is stagnant growth, increased inequality, and increased immiseration. So that's the economic crisis. And also, a precondition, it has been the littering of much of the global south with cheap weaponry and networks of men, primarily men, trained in the arts of asymmetrical warfare, either as guerrillas or counterinsurgents. And with the end of the Cold War, all these great ideological causes went away, but all those skills and people are there. And so now into this comes extreme weather. And in region after region that I looked at in Tropic of Chaos, you see conflict, ethnic conflict, religious conflict, sometimes class conflict, sometimes urban conflict, displaced from the countryside, struggles over state power. And all these things are not reducible to climate change, but it doesn't take much investigation or historical analysis to see that a contributing factor pushing these conflicts forward, making the pre-existing problem of the legacy of Cold War militarism and the legacy of neoliberal economic restructuring, making that stuff even worse and blossom into civil wars as in Syria.
Take an example that everybody...
Extreme weather. People adapt by, if there isn't some program of economic growth and redistribution for them, they adapt to environmental crises by picking up the gun and going after their neighbors or going after the state.
Obvious question, but how many degrees of separation, say, between ISIS and climate?
Well, there's I don't know how, I wouldn't put a number on it, but what happens is there's a very serious drought in Syria at the same time that the Assad regime starts in under pressure from Western financial interests, cutting assistance to Sunni farmers. The Assad regime is an Alawite minority regime. It is, a branch of Shia Islam. These Sunni farmers facing this intense drought, they have limited support from the state. They move into cities. Similarly, they are greeted with austerity there. And so these economic problems rooted in an environmental crisis blossom as a sectarian crisis between sort of lumpenized, newly impoverished class of Sunnis and this Alawite state. And that blossoms into the Syrian civil war. But the backstory to all that also includes the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the whole destabilization of that region and the whole flow of weapons in and out of Iraq in the course of the whole U.S. occupation there.
The mother of so much of this disaster in Iraq, for sure, and our war there. Austerity has also been imposed by us on Puerto Rico, has also been cited as a part of the problem there. I wonder, Christian, would you just speak to the generational stakes visible today, but that will be played out in this fight in the future?
The generational stakes?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Well, what's at stake? I mean, two-thirds of Puerto Rico's infrastructure has been destroyed. So potentially, this is an opportunity for profiteering, for for-profit firms to come in and buy up public resources at rock-bottom prices. But it could also be an opportunity to rebuild Puerto Rico on a sustainable footing with a completely different kind of electrical grid that's not dependent on fossil fuels, that can engage with sustainable agriculture, and the island can rebuild in a fashion that is both mitigating of the problem, i.e. getting off of fossil fuels and getting onto renewable energy, and adaptive, preparing in the fashion you were describing earlier in the Cuban example, preparing for the fact that Puerto Rico is going to be hit again and again and again, as are many other regions. Particularly, interestingly, particularly on the Atlantic coast, sea levels are rising unevenly, and they're rising fastest in the North Atlantic. So, many people in your listening area in the next couple of decades are going to see cities get hammered by hurricanes.
Jason, a word before the break. How do we rethink nature and work and agriculture, especially, but labor?
We have to start with agriculture. And this is something that Puerto Rico and Cuba have in common. They have their histories as sugar colonies. Now, what does that have to do with climate change? Well, it turns out an awful lot, because the birth certificate of modern industrial agriculture, which has been an absolute a massive driver of greenhouse emissions, carbon emissions, and climate change, the birth certificate is that of the sugar plantation, which emerges in the Atlantic world in the age of Columbus. So there you have the question of agriculture, of climate, of work, of race, and class all together. And it speaks to the reality that we have to unthink agriculture from the ground up and from up to the ground to really get a handle on climate change. The biggest single driver of greenhouse emissions is land clearance, forestry, and agriculture taken together. There will be no resolution of climate crisis. There will be no climate justice without food justice.
Unthink, maybe rethink. We'll come back to you, Jason. Coming up, a thought experiment, or maybe a mood test. What if we have all fundamentally intuited what is coming in this big crisis, but will not speak it? This is Open Source. Roy Scranton came back from his army service in Iraq with a grim take on the war that became his metaphor of nothing less than the modern world. It is our condition now, he would tell you, that we are moments away from death. All day, every day, and we know it. After Iraq, Roy Scranton earned a PhD in literature at Princeton and wrote two books that have made waves. First, the novel War Porn, and then an extended essay titled Learning to Die in the Anthropocene, Reflections on the End of a Civilization. He invited us this week to meditate on our fear that it's game over, not for the human species necessarily, but over as it was for the Sumerians or the Aztecs once upon a time.
The most terrible thing and most frightening thing I saw in Iraq while I was there and over the later years of the American occupation was the sectarian conflict that emerged out of the collapse of Iraqi society and the devastation that we caused to Iraqi infrastructure. We pulled out the social and economic infrastructure that held Iraq together. And when we did that, people started fighting each other and started killing each other. And that, more than anything, I think, is my worry for the future. And of course, it's already happening. I don't have to worry about whether or not it's going to happen. It's clear that nationalism is spreading. People are responding by saying, I'll get mine. They're building walls. A lot of people are preparing to fight out this coming catastrophe. The thing is, the future's here. The climate's changing. You know, learning to die in the Anthropocene and what I found, I think, for myself and maybe what I can offer some people is an idea of acceptance that I hope is freeing. Look at the science and look at the solutions on offer and understand that the game's over and that there's no happy ending and that we're all going to die. But the good news is we were all going to die anyway because that's just part of being human. And now, accepting that fact and understanding our human limits, we can then take the next step, which is really coming to terms with and making a decision about how we want to live in this moment we have. I think that's the choice we are living through now? How do we let this end? Do we want it to go down in fire? Or is there some possibility for a more compassionate and gentle decline?
I put it to you, Christian Parenti and Jason Moore, is he serious? I wonder if that's a sort of party trick, a mood experiment, as I said. Jason Moore, what do you think?
Well, I think it borders on the banal, I hate to say, that, it is a moment, I think a historic moment of choice for the vast majority on this planet. I think that what's missing from Scranton's often brilliant insights is not just the critique of capitalism, but a historical appreciation of these moments of collapse. You mentioned the Aztecs and the Sumerians. But really, in the history even of what's often called the West, we have two magnificent examples of what happens when a civilization can no longer carry on business as usual. One was the collapse of Roman power in Central and Western Europe after the 4th and 5th centuries. And that's a long story, but let me just make a quick point that essentially the 1% of the Roman ruling class was liquidated. They lost their capacity to keep doing business as usual, and peasants reasserted themselves. They occupied the villas. They repurposed them, and they set up a society that was remarkably equal, not just in terms of class, but also in terms of gender. It was a golden age for peasants in 5th and 6th century, 7th century Central and Western Europe. Now, fast forward 1,000 years. At the end of feudalism, a massive climate change comes in. The Little Ice Age begins right around the year 1300. And what happens? Well, it sets in motion a whole series of nasty things, famines and wars and all the rest. But what we forget, it wasn't a crisis. Feudalism did not go down because there were too many people on the land and then there was a plague and everyone died. Feudalism came to an end because the peasants and workers said, no way, we are not going back. We are not going to accept some more brutal form of feudalism. And I think that's what we're looking at in Trump's America, a more brutal form of capitalism. And the question is, will that kind of history repeat itself? Will people say, no, we're not going to go back to this absolutely brutal, racist form of capitalism? We want something different, and the climate, oh yeah, the climate's changing and we have to do something about that.
Christian Parenti, do you take Roy Scranton seriously? I mean, confronting mortality is...
I take him seriously, but I think Jason's points are correct as well. We all die, civilizations do decline and collapse, and ultimately life on Earth will end when, you know, in a billion and a half years, whatever, when the sun expands and cools and expands. But, you know, in the meantime, we have to live through this. And I think the danger with Roy Scranton's argument is that it's an invitation to cynicism. And if we are to make a transition to a more just society of the type that Jason is invoking, you know, we need to struggle to do that. That's right. Not going to happen passively. And people, that's not going to happen. We can't make that transition if people become cynical and check out.
Well, that's the contrast I heard between sort of self-sedating Roy Scranton and Kumi Naidoo speaking out of Black South Africa saying, no, you fight, you fight, you fight, you suffer, and then you win. Back to basics. You know, they used to say, you know, pain is a message from your body. Storms, new deserts are a message from nature. Who's hearing the message from this new nature, and who's getting it? And then who's ready to have who's got a strategy? But first, who's getting the message? Who speaks for nature in this new world? That's for you, Jason.
Well, it's a dangerous question, because we have to begin by realizing that this divide, that we live in a world that what humans do is called society and is goes on in one box, and what nature does is without humans goes on in another box. We have to recognize that's part of the problem. In fact, the environmentalist message that we need to save nature or we need to prevent the war against nature, that is part of the thinking that has created this sorry state of affairs. So we need to ask questions about what kind of civilization, what kinds of values, what kinds of work do we want to prioritize? Do we want to prioritize work of care and of reciprocity and of acknowledging the unpaid work, not just of all humans, because as we know, the economy would shut down if not for the unpaid work, especially of women in social reproduction, but also for the work of all nature as a whole. So I think we need, if we ask who speaks for nature, we need to begin by asking who is nature and are we part of it? And then the other part of your question is
vital. I hear you trying to make nature a sort of a guest in our humanistic project or something.
Well, I think that would be a mistake. I think that we are part of nature, and what we are finding is, I mean, any ecologist will tell you this, that species make environments, and the environments are making the species all at the same time.
Yes.
So what this means is, if we take that seriously, civilizations too make environments, and the environments are making them at the same time. That leads to a fundamentally different kind of politics. So that when we are talking about something like justice, we refuse to separate out the questions of, say, environmental sustainability and worker justice, this old jobs versus environment question, which keeps coming up again and again, because we realize that what is at stake now is the capacity of the planet to sustain life, and what kind of life will it sustain. So that leads you to a very different kind of politics, one that centers the work of humans, but also the work of other natures, of other animals, of ecosystems and forests and all the rest that are absolutely fundamental. We are not going to have human justice or human sustainability without recognizing and valuing the life and work of the planet as a whole. Now, that speaks to who's hearing this.
Who's
getting this?
Christian Peretti, are you hearing a strategy here? And do you see anywhere on the planet a state that understands its responsibility in the new world?
Not fully. I mean, I think that Cuba, in its storm preparedness and its also its adaptation during the critical period to at least a, you know, not completely, but a significant expansion of organic agriculture, mm-hmm. really embodies some of the best of what every country should be trying to do. And I think who's hearing it is like everyone who's experiencing it. Whether they're hearing it as precisely like this is climate change is another question, but people are experiencing crisis all over the world, including in the United States, and it's economic crisis that's bound up with this environmental crisis. And one of the things I think that is important to remember about this crisis compared to previous ones is the intensely toxic and complex nature of this society. So that's part of what makes me committed to like a green modernity that Scranton's comments seem to sort of not take into effect. That and also if we think about what is a transition to a different sort of society going to look like, we don't have the luxury to walk away from these, you know, atomic power plants that are extremely toxic and any other number of facilities. So I think that while this system, global capitalism, dominated by the ideology of, you know, market uberalis, neoliberalism, is definitely in decline and headed for a terminal crisis.
I just wanted to
embrace this idea of being organized, that government plays an important role, and that we have to institutionalize the ethos of solidarity and reciprocity, the stuff that Jason was talking about, that can't just be kind of out in the air, but like a political project that movements catalyze through government.
Aren't you surprised both of you that our politics is not more panicked? We haven't heard a party to rescue us from Roy's end of everything.
Well, we're in a moment in American history that we can see two clear parallels in terms of massive generational shifts that led to massive political upheaval. And of course, one was in the 1960s and the other was in the 1930s. What's going to happen today, it looks to combine elements of both. I mean, what I find overwhelmingly, not just with my students, but traveling around, and I'm sure Christian can say similar things, is that there is a massive generational shift in terms of thinking about how the politics of something called nature and how the politics of justice and work fit together in a way that was really completely absent from the birth of modern environmental politics after 1968, which was overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly about consumption, overwhelmingly about protecting the sacred object called nature. And you've seen it with the behavior of the big green groups over the past 30, 40 years. We're seeing a shift here, and we're seeing a way to bring together the spirit of Occupy Wall Street with Black Lives Matter, with other movements, recognizing that all of these questions of justice fundamentally touch on questions of nature in one way or another.
I'm hearing mainly dread more than activism among the young people in my family. Do you hear otherwise? I mean, do we hear a plan? Do we hear a strategy? Do we have a Bernie Sanders for the environmental crisis?
Well, I think we need the movement. What do you think, Christian?
Yeah, we don't have a Bernie Sanders for the environmental movement, but there, you know, I'm not seeing dread and complacency among my students at John Jay. People are angry and they're worried, but, you know, partly because they're young, they're committed to struggling on. And I always tell them, I say, you know, you got to be like the miners who were trapped a couple years ago in, I think it was in Bolivia, or maybe it was Ecuador. You know, there were a bunch of miners that were trapped. There was no rational reason to think they were going to survive. Yet what they did was they organized themselves. They went on a watch system. Everybody tried to sleep to conserve oxygen. They shared the water. They shared the food. They made special dispensations for the young miners who'd never been in these kind of crises and were freaking out. And it was totally irrational at one level, yet they were saved. And, you know, that's what people have to do. And I think that's what,
let us think,
if you're at the beginning of your life, you know.
It's a beautiful picture. Christian, let us think like trapped miners. Thank you, Christian Parenti and Jason Moore. Finally, I called Edwige Dontica, the Haitian-American writer at home in Brooklyn now, just to hear any reflection that a beloved Caribbean artist wanted to share on the storm of storms in this year, 2017. It took her just a moment to pick a poem of her own to read.
A year ago, when Hurricane Matthew hit the Caribbean, particularly Haiti, we were going through some of the same things that people and other parts of the Caribbean now, in Barbuda, in the Virgin Islands, and many other places, but particularly what's going on now in Puerto Rico. When I look at the scenes in Puerto Rico, it breaks my heart, and it doubly breaks my heart because it reminds me so much of what we have gone through in Haiti at different times, especially last year at the very same time. Some of the same problems are occurring there with the agriculture. Oh, so many trees destroyed and so many homes and the lack of power and the lack of food and the lack of water and the extreme need. It's all so familiar to us who are from the most vulnerable places in the Caribbean, including Haiti. So the piece I put together is called Crossing. In Creole, it would be like a quasi, and Crucis in Spanish. I felt you reaching out to touch me where the winds pulled you and the oceans tried to bury you. I still am not able to reach back, to cup myself, to fill your hand. And this whole world that smells like the sea, and the trees strewn about like bones poking through a ruptured skin. We need a moment longer together, for we are floating on different currents towards this brutal eternity. Please, write me something with your breath and one of those tongues yet to be heard. They say there will be no countries in the future. 25 years and everything will be water and dust. Do you already know the name of that world? Tell me now, or whisper it into this impossible darkness, or hiss it in my distant ear. Tell me quickly. Que debo enseñar? Que debo aprender? What am I to teach them? What am I to learn?
Merci bon Dieu, gardez comment la misère finit pour nous.
I asked my friend Edwige if it was all right to add the greeting that Haitians often use with me. Ay bobo, we say. There's no literal translation, but it seems to cheer us up. Thank you, Edwige Dantica, Christian Parenti, and Jason Moore. Thanks to Stuart Schwartz at Yale and Kumi Naidu in Seattle. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Frank Horton. Susan Coyne makes our wonderful illustrations. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is the name of our storm. I'm Christopher Lydon.